So that shows on the right-hand side there the linear accelerator and the patient's down beneath the radiation beam, and you can see that the beam is shaped, and the shaping is done with what's known as a multi-leaf collimator, MLC. And you see the beam comes down through this hole here, for all of you who don't know this, and each of these is a opaque to the radiation and can move out into the field in such a way that the field is very, very highly shaped. Yeah. So that as the beam rotates around the patient, yeah, you can see here the different orientations of the beam. For each angle, there will be a unique set of settings for those fingers that go out so that you very tightly shape the beam around the contours of the tumor. Not only that, but as the beam is rotating around and each angle is selected for irradiation, then in real time during that irradiation, you actually move these fingers back and forth. And this creates a beam intensity pattern so that some spots are hotter than others. Yeah. And very tightly conforms the radiation to the patient. And this technique is known as IMRT, Intensity Modulated Radiation Therapy, and it's just now coming onto the scene as a major way of doing things. And the reason I introduce it this way is because the talk will focus on what it means to have highly heterogeneous distributions of dose, because one of the consequences of this very tight conformation using all of these multi-leaf collimators is you actually increase the heterogeneity of the beam that you give. In the old days when we had just maybe two beams coming this way, yeah, and then the tumor is irradiated in the middle, you had highly homogeneous dose distributions. Now we're going to much more heterogeneous dose distributions. And I think this is nicely illustrated in this case for a head and neck patient. So there you see his eyes, his spinal cord, and there are 9 fields going around, and each of these fields has a little beamlet intensity, you see that, and they're all different, and those occur because of the real-time changes in the fingers for each of the angles, okay? Now, going back to the prostate tumor, this is probably the same figure that Mike Milosevic showed, to introduce another concept important for the talk. So here you see a patient's prostate. There's his spinal cord. The dark green is the rectum. Yeah. This light green is the bladder. The blue is the prostate, and the red is the seminal vesicles. And you can see that these isodose contours wrapping around it in this sagittal cut, which is a cut which is going through the patient like this, define the places where the dose is constant. And you can see that it drops off as you go away from the place where you target it. And we can also do a coronal cut through the other plane, and we get a picture that's like this. There's the bladder back there, and you can see the prostate, but you can't see the rectum. Two other affected normal tissues in this treatment are the femoral heads here. Yeah. And here's our coronal distribution. So having said all of this, how is this information incorporated into the computers which choose which of these beam angles and which of these fingers go out when? Because all of this is driven by a computer-controlled estimate of how much danger there is in a particular linear combination of beams from different angles. Yeah. And the way this dose information to different volumes of tissue and different tissues is incorporated is in the dose volume histogram. So what is that? Take these tissues one at a time. If you take the bladder, which is the light green, you see over here there's this object that is light green, and you can't see the axis here, but this axis is radiation dose, increasing radiation dose, and this axis is percent volume. So taking these tissues one at a time, for example, the bladder, yeah, then you see that as the dose increases, a lower and lower percent of the total bladder is irradiated. So this axis is the percent of the entire tissue at risk that is irradiated to the dose that's set up on the x-axis. Is that clear? And for the rectum, that's the dark green, you can see this dose volume histogram. And so this is a way of incorporating information about how high was the dose and how much of the tissue got irradiated. Yeah? Okay. The red and the blue are the tumor that you want to irradiate, and there you're happy because you see it's very close to the prescription dose that you wanted to give this patient. Right? You can see that. The red is the tubule, the blue is the prostate. So that's our dose volume histogram. The one thing to take home about this is that it contains no information about where the dose is. Okay, so if I tell you that, you know, 20% of the bladder received a dose of 60 gray, you don't really know if it was this part of the bladder that got the 60 gray or that part of the bladder over there. Okay, and that's central to what I would like to develop this morning in these cluster models. First, though, why do we even care about the dose? And this shows an analysis of data that in a multi-institutional study that we did. Along the y-axis you have the percent of the patients who remain free of recurrence of disease. And along here we have time after treatment. And the point of this graph is to show that as the dose increases, more and more patients remain free of disease for longer. Right? And so from the point of view of tumor cure, the dose matters in prostate cancer. From the point of view of rectal toxicity, the dose also matters. So here you see, this is now the opposite. This is the percent of patients who experience a certain grade of rectal toxicity. And you can see that as the dose increases, it goes up, right, toward 20%. The good news is that IMRT, intensity modulated radiotherapy, can give a high dose with fewer complications. Why is that? Because the beam is more tightly contoured around the prostate. A caveat, before I go further in the talk, is that whenever you talk about clinical data, you're talking about very heterogeneous data. And this is just to point out that the increase that you see in the fraction free of treatment failure as you increase the radiation dose is particular to a subgroup of the patients. It doesn't hold for all the patients. For example, it doesn't hold for the patients with very early tumors there. You don't have to give such a big dose. For the ones with very advanced tumors, it doesn't matter what dose you give. Okay? So I'd like now to switch to just a few remarks on how we have modeled at the micro level. I've been showing you macro information. How do you model from the micro level what's going on when you, to a particular part of the bladder, you give a certain dose? And we talk about the killing of individual cells, and we talk about the killing of units that these cells are hypothetically organized into. Most of what I will be telling you is modeling is based on very, very little experimental data. We do know that if S is the surviving fraction in the sense of they remain clonogenic and can grow clones of cells after a dose X, that the log of S is quadratic in the dose. We know that. And that typical radiotherapy is a large number of fixed doses given, say, 5 days a week for 6 or 7 weeks, all those doses more or less the same. And in that case, this factor, depending on the individual dose, X will be constant. D is the total dose that you give, that you accumulate. So the log of the surviving fraction of cells will decrease linearly with the total dose. Okay? And this is just a comment that these two parameters are dependent on the LET or the efficiency of energy deposition per unit track length as they go along. You have high LET and low LET radiations, and the beta, the second coefficient, depends on the dose rate, how fast you deliver the irradiation, and on the LET. What do I mean by fixed dose? That means you come in each day to be treated and you get 2 gray. Yeah, that's a prescription dose each day. It's a fixed dose. Of course, if you look at the dose volume histogram, you will say it's not fixed because different parts get different doses, and you would be right. but the prescription dose is fixed each day. Okay? Constant dose. A different word. Okay. So it is a hypothesis that the NTCP, which is what I will use to say normal tissue complication probability, NTCP, depends on the secondary organization of these target cells into functional subunits, FSU. An example would be the kidney, which is organized in the nephrons, and that the probability that an FSU will be killed depends on the probability that you kill all the cells in the FSU. So these, in a sense, are tiny tumorlets that comprise, go together to make up a normal tissue. And so if the number of the target cells per FSU is N, then the probability that you sterilize such a functional subunit is given by the probability that zero target cells will survive, which is this product, exponential of this product. And then if you put the models that we put in there, then you see that if the log of the target cells we call A, and this constant factor, putatively constant factor alpha plus beta x, we call B, then you can model the killing of radiation at the micro level with two parameters in case the fixed dose or the constant dose really is fixed, but in case the dose is heterogeneous in the patient, which it is, then it probably requires three parameters, right? A, alpha, and beta, because the coefficient of each daily dose to this particular part of the bladder or the rectum is different, okay? So this is how dose comes in it. We're talking about cluster models of dose volume effects. And so this is just to make the point that I've just made about how many parameters at that level are required to see what the density or the probability of killing these FSUs is. What about volume? We have dose volume models. And the volume effect, very briefly, is that if you give to a normal tissue a given dose and then increase the volume of the normal tissue to which you give the same dose, you get a higher probability of a complication. So for the same level of killing of FSUs, if you increase the volume of those that you give the dose at the same level of killing, you will increase the probability of complication. And that is called the volume effect. And all of this together we're talking about is known as the dose volume effect in radiotherapy. And this is an illustration of it for the canine spinal cord, data published in 1998. And this shows the frequency of paralysis of the animal as a function of the total dose that was given in fractionated doses of size 3 gray, as I recall. And in these dogs, 4 centimeters of the spinal cord was irradiated, and in these dogs, 20 centimeters was irradiated. They were irradiated to uniform doses. So there was no variability of the dose across the spinal cord. And just ignore all of these fittings. I just wanted to illustrate the data and what that looks like. So there's a big effect based on just how long the segment of the spinal cord was. Since the dose was the same, you know that the actual cell killing was the same, but if you gave 60 gray, you would paralyze about 10% of the dogs where the spinal cord was 4 centimeters long, irradiated, and you would paralyze about 60% of the dogs the same dose when it was 20 centimeters. And then just to remind you with our picture of the dose volume histogram that this is not at all what happens in radiotherapy, because the picture is complicated by a high dose here, a high dose over here, 2 high doses, no one knows where they are, but whatever, the information is not conveyed by the dose volume histogram. This is just a summary, yeah? And so the next part, I'd like to digress for about 5 minutes. Yes?
I don't understand
your diagram. Yeah. So on the x-axis, we have total dose accumulated over all these individual treatments. Yeah, 50, 60, 70 gray. On the y-axis, we have percent. Percent of what? Percent of rectal wall, percent of the bladder, total volume, percent of the femoral head's total volume, that are irradiated to the dose on the x-axis, or greater than that dose. Okay? So if I want to know, in a summary way, what is the total picture in volume and dose terms of what I'm doing to the rectal wall, this is a summary of it. Clear?
So you pick any
dosage,
right?
Yeah.
So
pick this dose here, 60, and you apply it, say, to the bladder. So this tells me that 15% of the bladder got at least 60 gray. Okay? Okay?
So the tumor,
right. Got a high dose. Got a high dose. So what I will come to in the cluster modeling is an attempt to improve on the information available from the dose volume histogram by accounting for where the dose is going, not just summing it all up, okay? And so this leads me to a digression into percolation theory. I don't know if mathematicians in here know about this or not. percolation theory is developed in the 1950s as a mathematical discipline to handle the organization of random groupings on lattices, for example. And we'll go through some applications to make it clear, but just to get the subject started, suppose we're in two dimensions and we have a matrix, and these elements are random, equal to 1 or 0 according to some probability p. So they have a value 1 with probability p, and a value 0 with probability 1 minus p, and this is independently the case. Okay? An S cluster is an isolated grouping of S adjacent 1s in the matrix, where adjacency means either vertically they're neighbors, or horizontally neighbors, but not by the vertices. And so this is a matrix to give you an example. You see that we have 3, 5, 7, 9 ones and a total of 16, and therefore P is 9/16 in this case. That's the probability of a 1. And if you look for the clustering that's taking place here, you can see that there is a 3 cluster right here. There is a 2 cluster. These are 1 clusters. And so if you look at this is a 4 cluster. There's 1 4 cluster. There are 2 2 clusters. Where is the second? Bottom right. There's a 2. There are 2 2 clusters. And there's 1 1 cluster. Okay? And so you can calculate the mean cluster size, sigma 4, for a value of p of 9/16, 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 4. Is 9/4. Yeah? And so now if you imagine that these lattices get bigger and bigger, and you have a fixed value of P for the probability that there will be a 1, that the mean size of the cluster is going to get bigger. And the question in percolation theory is, when do you get an infinite cluster? What is the value of P for which an infinite cluster appears? Okay, and so if you let n go to infinity, you can have an infinite two lattice. Sigma of p is defined as the mean cluster size, and the p value for which you have sigma p equal to infinity, the first infinite cluster, is called the percolation threshold, or the critical probability. So is that clear? You've seen it before. Oh, you never saw it before. Okay? So the critical probability is the unique value of P for which an infinite cluster appears in the infinite square lattice. Yeah? And we don't care about one dimension. Now, by lattice, of course, you can have a one lattice, a two lattice, a five lattice, however many dimensions. And in percolation theory, the one-dimensional case is trivial because percolation can only occur at the right-hand side where P is equal to 1. Otherwise, if you have any zeros, you don't get a percolation. And these are all called site percolation models. There are other type of percolation models that I won't go into. You ask yourself, where is this percolation threshold? For a two-lattice, it occurs, and you can derive rigorous bounds. And the first reference on that list of references under percolation models is a nice reference to the constants. These are rigorous bounds for the percolation threshold on two lattices. And you can do calculations, Monte Carlo calculations, to indicate that it's almost exactly equal to 6/10. It's just less than 6/10. Okay? So that's the percolation threshold for two lattices. Now, the last point to bring up about percolation is, what about the mean cluster? What about the maximum cluster size? So far, we've been talking about sigma is the mean cluster size. What about the maximum cluster size? Because in my mind, I'm going to lead now to the hypothesis that normal tissue complications are connected somehow with the likelihood that damage will cluster together, yeah, instead of being spread out. So that if you give a dose and you induce cell killing in these functional subunits, you can have two situations. One where the damage, the clusters are very small and you will not get a complication. In another situation, clusters are contiguous and you do get a complication. So, and it will matter how big the biggest cluster is for a given P. And so if C2NP denotes the mean maximum cluster size for the two-dimensional lattice, these are asymptotic results from percolation theory. When you're at probabilities less than the percolation probability, it's asymptotically increasing as the log of n. When your percolation probability is greater than PC, it goes as n squared. And right at the percolation threshold, it increases as the power n to the s, so at the s power of n, where S is equal to 91/48. That's also in the article that I referred to. And this is called the scaling exponent. And because it's between 1 and 2, it indicates the maximum cluster at the threshold as a fractal. That means that it does not increase its size as an integer power of n. So that's enough. What are the applications of percolation theory? A forest fire can be modeled by a square lattice where a tree on fire ignites its nearest neighbor. How long does the fire last? And you can show that the fire lasts the longest when you're right at the percolation threshold. Epidemics in orchards, same situation. You can have a probability that's dependent on how you space the trees, and you can space them far apart and not get epidemics that wipe out the orchard, or epidemics that do wipe out the orchard. Ferromagnetism, if you take a metal that is magnetic and you subject it to an oscillating electric field, you induce magnetism in it, and then you increase the metal temperature from zero to T and then decrease it back to zero. And if T is high enough, there's no residual magnetism in the metal, then there's a critical temperature called TC, and at that below that temperature, there will be residual magnetism in the metal. And many others, polymerization, the productivity of oil fields. If you drill a well, what's the likelihood there'll be percolation in the field? Extreme market share in the media industry. Why is it that some television programs never get watched and the other ones get watched all the time? And so forth. Now, the last application, I've got to hurry because I'm running out of time, is cluster models. And as I told you, the hypothesis is that you get a normal tissue complication when there are sufficient large aggregates of sterilized functional subunits. Okay? And the critical feature, this is all hypothetical, is the mean maximum cluster size. And this will differ somewhat from the percolation models in that the emphasis is on maximum cluster size and finite lattices, not the mean cluster size and infinite lattices. One-dimensional cluster models are not trivial. They're important. And more highly compact clusters are more likely biologically relevant than the simply connected clusters from percolation theory. And I'll show you quickly what that means. Here is the same presentation of the dose relationship for the killing of functional subunits. But I point out that in the context of cluster models, the two important features of radiation-induced cell killing being random. Yeah? One is that the number of the sterilized FSUs that you will get is a randomly distributed binomial quantity about the mean. And secondly, their location is assumed to be random, just as we saw in the site percolation models. So to show you what I mean by that, suppose that we have a 4x4 lattice and that the probability or the density of sterilized FSU is 1/4, 25%. These are both realizations. In this case, we have 5 sterilized FSUs, because that's a reasonable number if 4 is the mean. Okay. And you can see there are no clusters. They're all one clusters. In this case, we have 4 sterilized FSUs, and there's, in fact, a 3 cluster. Is that clear? Okay. One-dimensional models. This graph shows the mean size of the largest cluster as a function of the density or the probability of killing. And you can see that over a long range of these densities, it's approximately an exponential increase. It's smooth over the entire range. And we know from percolation theory that the percolation threshold is at the far end, is equal at 1. But these are valid models for application to one-dimensional objects by our hypothesis. This shows the variance of those distributions when n is equal to 200. So what distribution? It's the distribution of the maximum cluster size. That's a random variable. And for low densities, it's tight. And as the density increases, the variance gets very, very big. Okay? This shows now the spinal cord data again and shows the fit of a model called a parallel model that's based on dose volume histograms versus a logistic model, which is just a statistical model, the solid lines. And the cluster model is the dotted lines. And you can see by these jumps and irregularities in here, we've done this by Monte Carlo simulation. And this was with 1,000 runs for the mean cluster size. To take those jumps out, we would have to go to at least 10,000 or more. Just to indicate, to remind you of what I mean by the contiguous or not contiguous hotspots, we have predicted what would have happened had they done an experiment where a 12-centimeter length of spinal cord was irradiated, yeah, versus 6 2-centimeter segments separated from each other. And you can see that the parallel model, based on dose volume histograms, predicts the same result whichever way you do it, because the dose volume histogram is exactly the same for one uninterrupted 12-centimeter segment or 6 2-centimeter segments, whereas the cluster models predict different cluster sizes and, in fact, a rightward shift of the dose response curve. Now, coming back to connectivity, all of percolation theory is built on what we call one connectivity, and that means that there is, from any site on the lattice of interest, there's a minimum of one step that you take to reach any other member of the cluster. There may be more, but it's possible to have just one step, you know, one path to go from the site of interest on the lattice to any other site that is a member of the lattice. And if you look at the, talking about two-dimensional models now, at the same graph, how does the mean largest cluster size increase with density? You see it is quite different from one-dimensional models, that the right where the percolation theory predicts that there's going to be a percolation threshold or a critical probability, there's a qualitative change in the behavior of the mean maximum cluster size. So here you see the size n squared, 350, 200, and so forth. And over here, it increases in a completely different way. And what's happening is that you can imagine that once, this, by the way, is for a 20 by 20 lattice at density 0.65, so it's above the percolation threshold, that any additional sterilized FSUs immediately attach to the large cluster. So I imagine if we expanded this lattice infinitely, we would find that these small clusters here remain as they are, but this is a member of the infinite cluster, okay? And immediately you attach each additional FSU, and this is shown by the fact that if you plot 40,000, say 200 squared times the density, you get this line, and it's asymptotic to the estimate of the mean size of the large cluster, largest cluster. That is, that everything that goes in there is part of the largest cluster, okay? Excuse me? I'm sorry.
How many time steps in the Monte Carlo
steps? How many?
Time steps in the Monte Carlo steps.
How many runs?
We had to do 1,000 runs to get this these estimates of the mean maximum cluster size. 1,000, yeah. Yeah. So there's still some roughness in it, you can see. Yeah. And we have done 10,000, and it goes out with 10,000. This is the variance of the mean largest cluster size in two dimensions with one connectivity. And you can see at the percolation threshold, the variance is shooting off to very large numbers. Then we went with two connectivity as being more biologically reasonable for the types of applications you could think of as, for example, ulceration of the rectal wall after prostate treatments. Two connectivity being that there are at least two paths from any site on the lattice of interest to any other member of the lattice, at least two. And you can see this drastically reduces the sizes of the clusters, but it makes them more regularly shaped objects rather than those skeleton-like objects with one connectivity. You also see when you look at the mean size that you have shifted the percolation threshold to much higher probability densities. Okay, so I won't go into the details here to try to finish up quickly. Three connectivity, it shifts it even more, but it's not important because this is all hypothetical anyway. Finishing up, model validation. So this is all hypothesis. How would we go about, and that's what we're trying to do now. And I would cite three different things as approaches to this. The first one is just retrospectively, whoops, I see that what was seen on a Macintosh is not seen on a PC. grid therapy is a therapy where a lead plate has holes drilled in it. You put it under the radiation beam so that only where you have the holes, the beam goes through. Yeah, and this allows the delivery of doses that would not be tolerated without the lead plate and the separation of the beam into these holes. Yeah. And so we think that this is consistent with separating one large contiguous cluster without that into 64 or whatever the number of holes is, disassociated hotspots. Okay? I'm sorry I couldn't show you that picture. And this was to explain why it would have made a difference. This is a woman who has had a severe reaction after postoperative breast cancer irradiation. And our interpretation of the results from grid therapy would be, in this case, she received higher dose here than she did here, because here you can see the epithelium is healing. But here you can see the only thing that's happening is the reemergence of these little bumps, which represent multiplying surviving clones from a single or a few cells, okay, on the skin. Here, practically none. And the idea would be that if you disperse these areas of hot activity, as was the case here, you would get healing at doses that would not be tolerable were all of the damage contiguous. And then we've run a simulation to show that this is indeed the case with cluster models. This is just to show that if you have a background irradiation to this large lattice here of some low dose, and then give high doses to four different squares, which are either contiguous or separated in various ways, that there's quite a difference in the cluster size, the mean largest cluster size that you get when that dose is as high as, that density is as high as 8/10. You can see that for the dispersed pattern, these clusters arise and increase in size to this size cluster. It does not occur for lower levels of dose. So obviously there are constraints on when this is actually going to work. I think it may be predictive. A second, I think, approach to this, and I'm talking to radiotherapists at MD Anderson about this, whether or not there exists a percolation dose. A percolation dose would be a dose where the qualitative dependence of the volume effect suddenly changes, just as we've seen in the case of those graphs. And if you assume that the behavior of the normal tissue complication probability is some threshold effect, but continuous near the threshold T, I'm not going to take you through the details. These are the asymptotic expressions. Then if you can differentiate it and look at the rate of change of that complication probability with respect to area, and there you see the change below the percolation threshold is a constant. Above it, it increases linearly with the volume. So as the volume went up, you would have a geometrically increasing probability to get the normal tissue complication at the same dose. So it looked completely different from what it did below the percolation threshold. Are there clinical examples of this out there? And so we're looking at individual patients who have been treated for prostate cancer, cervical cancer, and head and neck cancer to try to separate them into groups where this did or did not happen, and look in detail at the hotspot distributions from the CT scans and the 3D dosimetry. So there's the conjecture that there is a percolation dose. So I'll move on to the conclusions. The high technology that Mike Milosevic was talking about will have as a consequence increasing heterogeneity of the hotspots that occur in these patients. And one way to approach this and modeling it is cluster models, but these models have not been validated by clinical data yet. And I'd like to end by just saying, I thought in a conference like this, what's needed from each side of the aisle? And I think from the cancer research point of view, we need a lot more prospective dose escalation studies that are carefully controlled during the follow-up period for the normal tissue sequelae that these patients suffered. There have been very few of these. An important one was done in the prostate. I think that's a typo. Is it 9604? 9604, not 9601. From the applied mathematics side, as far as I know, and I've looked at those books that are on your reference sheet, we don't know anything about higher cluster models with higher connectivity. And we'd be very, since I didn't point this out as we went through them, but the behavior of the maximum cluster size above the percolation threshold is the same regardless of connectivity, but it's different below the percolation threshold. What are the asymptotics for the largest cluster size at sub-percolation densities? Thank you very much.